Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to the Startup Grind.
So tonight's theme, we will be talking about Michael's startup story, but we also will be focusing on consumer behavior psychology. So one thing I was very fascinated when I was speaking to him was the fact that this is all around us. And it can sound a bit scary, but it's not always a bad thing. And actually, in a world full of so much noise, how can you make your business or your brand stand out? So as entrepreneurs here, that's a very important thing to learn. So that's what we'll be talking about today. Now let me just talk a little bit about Michael and his bio. So Michael Barbera is an award-winning consumer psychologist and strategy consultant for Fortune 50 companies. He is a business psychologist who is involved in both practical and academic endeavors. His areas of practice are consumer behavior, consumer emotions, social psychology, decision-making, brand management, marketing, and long-term business strategies. His clients can be found on the Fortune 50 list and several television programs, such as ABC's Shark Tank, Bravo's Million Dollar Listing. So Michael shares his research and experiences as a keynote speaker for public and private organizations, and as the host, and he's also the host of ClickSuasion podcast. In 2015, the White House recognized Michael for his contributions to entrepreneurship. This work includes development and validation of consumer emotions, consumer behavior, product placement, consumer experiences, and business growth strategies. So he has an amazing resume. All right, so without further ado, everybody, let's introduce Michael Barbera. All right, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what it is that you do, what is Barbera Solutions, and just kind of like do a brief interview, brief intro of what it is that you do.
Absolutely. So I'll give you an analogy. Everyone here has ate at Applebee's before? Has anybody here ever had the surf and turf? Okay. Not many people can say they had the surf and turf at Applebee's, but I see some heads shaking. Yes, that's awesome. So when you go to Applebee's and you open that trifold menu and you look to the top right and you see the entrees, you might see a surf and turf for about $25 or so, when they may only have one lobster tail in the freezer. But what that $25 surf and turf does is it makes that $11 burger look a lot more reasonable. So now you're no longer comparing to what the burger costs at Ruby Tuesday or other places. You're comparing what that burger costs to other items on the menu. So they're anchoring you. They're using consumer behavior, consumer psychology to make you make a decision that makes them more money. So Barbera Solutions is a consumer psychology, consumer experience lab that provides actionable research to organizations to help create a better consumer experience.
Okay, so I know one of the main topic for tonight is consumer behavior psychology, but before getting there, I kind of want to stick to the theme of Startup Grind, which is to talk about his startup story. So let's go ahead and begin with that. So tell us a little bit about how it all began. What got you into, you know, on starting your own business? When did you get the itch for entrepreneurism?
The itch really came when I fell right into it. So I was 13 years old, living in New York City, and I was a drummer in a rock band. And at this point in my life, I thought I was going to be a famous drummer. I thought I was going to be the next Lars Ulrich and be touring the world. It doesn't work out like that. Obviously, you don't see me touring the world right now. You don't know who I am by anything to do with music. So that didn't really pan out. But what did pan out was my guitar, well, our guitarist in our band had a home with a backyard. And if you have a home with a backyard in New York City, it's pretty phenomenal. It's not often you come across someone with a backyard. So every Halloween, we'd have this Halloween party. We'd throw like 3 or 4 bands up in the backyard and we'd have invite people over. And then this one year, his parents were selling the home. So we couldn't have a party. So I'm thinking there's gotta be a better way. And this is pre-internet days. So I start calling every possible venue in New York City in all 5 boroughs, from large concert halls to the VFW to the Knights of Columbus. I say, can I rent out your place? and I come across this place out in Staten Island called The Caves. Really cool facility. It's actually built into the rock. It's all caves. It was originally a brewery and a winery, and it had two stages, like five bars. And being 13 years old, when I would walk in there to talk to the owner-operator of the place, I looked like I was 22. So as long as I didn't go drink any alcohol, nobody ever really questioned the validity of me being in there. So I didn't abuse that privilege. So I met the owner-operator, and he said, yeah, I like your idea. We can put on a concert here. So I put on this concert with two stages, like 20-something bands. And at that age, the only thing I knew about business was revenue minus expenses equals profit. That's really all I knew. I just knew not to spend more than I was going to make. And we did it. We made a profit. I was like, that was kind of fun. A little work. Had a few failures along the way and learned some lessons, but it was fun. And the owner-operator said, why don't you do it again? I was like, well, I really haven't considered that. I did it again. And we did it two more times. And what you have there is a business. You have profit. And what it turns out was the owner-operator of that club called The Caves was A.J. Perro. A.J. Perro was the drummer for Twisted Sister. And so he became my first mentor. Not so much an overt mentor. He said, hey, Mike, come sit down. Let's have coffee and let's talk about what you can do in the next 5 years. But I just learned from what he did and more so from what he did not do. And that became the first mentor I had in life for business, for just growth, even maybe more so than my parents. And I just followed his lead. And then that business turned into another business, into another business. And the actual original business, Catalyst Promotions, is actually still in business today and operates out of Florida.
Wow. How exciting. So would you say, okay, so you had a mentor. Would you say that having a mentor is really important, especially when you're starting up a business or starting up in business in general?
I think we should always have a mentor. It doesn't matter if you are on a status equal to Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, to me, or you know someone as low as me, always have a mentor, regardless of what, we're always learning. If you stop learning, I think that's really that's the struggle. So if you can find someone who's willing to give you their time, their experience, and their intellectual property to be your mentor, accept it. Take them up on that. We can always learn from someone else, always. We Google videos every day on YouTube, how to mow the lawn, how to do this, how to do that. Well, why not have a real person tell us that, and you'll probably get more out of it.
That's great. So I imagine like when you were first starting up, there had to be a lot of obstacles. What is one of the biggest obstacles you faced, and how were you able to tackle that?
There's a lot of obstacles, and I could probably sit here for the next hour and a half and talk about obstacles after obstacle. I talk about the obstacle I had this morning. Podcast wouldn't load right. That's an obstacle. But I'd probably say the most significant obstacle of all, and it happens from day one till we all stop and retire, and even beyond that, is probably time management. We can all probably agree that time management is a beast, and we think we have something locked down. So today I could tell you I have something that is near perfect that works for me for time management. And 3 years from now, you can ask me, Mike, how was that 3 years ago? It was horrible. It was miserable. It was the worst strategy I ever came up with.
So tell us a little bit more about what you use for time management.
Well, I don't have, say, a process that I replicated from someone else, or I don't use, say, one specific app that nudges my behavior to do X, Y, and Z. I use my calendar, I use my to-do list from Evernote, and I block off specific times of the week for certain things. So say from 9 a.m., from 10 a.m., I'll do only this work, or this topic of work, and 10 to 11, this topic of work. Now, they're all challenges because things will pop up. People will email me that something that they think is urgent that has to get done right away. We'll probably get in the way of that. One really good thing that I like to do is before I even look at my email, I do the most important thing for the day. So if the business hours start at 9 o'clock, I usually get in around 7:45, 8 o'clock. And then for that hour 15 minutes, I do my most important task for the day or anything that takes the most creative skill from my mind so that no other tasks are in the way. And that way, I don't even look at email until 9 o'clock, and I can't even see what is even going to pop up in my day until 9 o'clock. So that really helps out a lot, too. One recommendation that I was given that works really well for some other people, it just doesn't fit my schedule, but I advocate for this if I can make it work, is to have a me meeting. And what I found that works really well is that some individuals will block out 4 hours every Friday from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. for a me meeting, for a mic meeting, and just leave it blank. And for all those little tasks that pile up on Monday, like, damn, I can't get this done. Tuesday, I can't get this done. Now, Wednesday, you're overwhelmed because you have all those extra tasks. Do those on Friday. Do that in your me meeting time. Don't schedule anything else but for yourself. And then if you really have nothing else going on between 1 and 5 on Friday, you have two options. You can do some professional development, or you can just go home.
I like that. So let me go ahead and start, you know, making my little me meeting for Friday. I think that would help me a lot. So let's pretend we had a machine that we could go back in time. What are some things that you would go back in time and change?
So I had an answer to that. I'm going to give you two answers because one came up as I was talking to Santiago earlier. And I'm going to mention that story as well. So the first one is I've always wanted to start a business that not so much regulated, but provided feedback on journalists. So you can look up a journalist, say John Smith writes for the New York Times. I give him a 4 out of 5, and here's my comment on that journalist. And you could also rate the journalist organization. I've tried several times to do an organization like this. It's failed several times. I've even invested in businesses that do this. They've all failed. So this has become the death of me trying to get something like this started. I've at this point given up, like it's just not gonna happen. But if an opportunity presented itself similar to that, I would probably be foolish and dive right in again. The one opportunity that Santiago and I were talking about earlier is probably real estate. So I have clients in real estate. We understand consumer decision-making in real estate, but myself as a real estate, say a realtor, understand how the industry really works? Probably not. And so I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York, and 30 years ago, there was a lot of no-go areas where if I told my mom, hey, I'm gonna go to this neighborhood, she would probably slap me on the side of the head. You're not going to the neighborhood. And today, it's probably one of the hottest real estate markets in the country. So if I had to go back in time, I'd probably go into real estate and buy up all that property, which was the places my mom would not want me to go 30 years ago.
So to summarize, you'd go back and disobey your mom to go and like invest in those areas, right?
Yes, but she's not gonna watch that part.
All right, I'm just kidding. So we read a little bit about your bio. Go ahead and feel free to touch up on some of those areas, some of the ones that you're most proud of. Where are you compared today compared to then when you were starting up?
Now, that's a really good question. And it's really easy to say that I'm successful, but how do you measure success? And one of the ways that I measure success is not that how much money you make or how much sales you do or who you work for, who your client list is. It's actually what you give back. So looking back 20, 30 years ago, whether it was from starting as a concert promoter in the music industry to operating a food truck or being a consultant back then, 30 years ago, I was chasing the dollar. I was chasing the next, you know, way to pay the rent, pay the mortgage. Now so much, it's really what can I give back? So we do a lot of research about Barrett Solutions that we not only do we sell, but yes, we do a lot of research that we actually give to government organizations to use it. So right now we have phenomenal and provocative research on the perception of using shared restrooms, gender-neutral restrooms. So that's been a hit topic that TED has actually invited us to do TED Talks on. We actually provide a lot of the research pro bono to the government to make policy on that. So it's not so much how much can we charge the government, how much money can we make, but how much change can we actually do with the research that we conduct behind closed doors that's not for our clients.
Congratulations on TED Talk. I'm looking forward to that.
Thanks.
So we've talked a little bit about his bio, his background, how he started. So let's go ahead and dig more into like consumer behavior psychology, which is what you're expert in. So marketing is a really big sector of like being able to use it to grow your business. How did you, what made you niche into the consumer behavior aspect of it?
So since I have a long entrepreneurial background, I really just matured into it from having an interest in marketing and having an interest into how people make decisions. Well, if I would just try to fall asleep one night and thinking like, how did that person do that? Or why do they do that? And how do they make that decision? How does it affect X, Y, and Z? And it really just a snowball effect into marketing. How can you use this for marketing? And then it turns out there's a degree for that. So it's like, you know what? Let me go get education on this. Let me actually learn how this actually works. And then after getting education, there's a significant amount of gap in research. And that has not been touched yet, and how consumers make decisions. But not so much consumers, but individuals, because every individual is a consumer. So individual decision-making, so I mentioned before about gender-neutral research, that's not really so much a consumer thing. Yes, it does affect consumers, because if one business has a restroom framed a certain way, a consumer may or may not use that retail store because of a restroom they have or how it's labeled, but they may use a facility because of how it's labeled. So it does affect consumer decision-making, but really it's about how humans make decisions or why we make them. And really, if I was to ask you, why did you buy that blue shirt? Or why did you buy that notebook? Or why did you choose that beer over something else? You're gonna tell me an answer, but the answer is really not the reason why you did it. So there was a reason why you get so many surveys that have nothing to do with the product. How likely are you to use this? Where do you use it? Or they track your data, big data, your zip code, where you go, what you do with your products. Every app asks you, oh, can we collect data from you? Can you fill out survey? That goes into a plethora of information about how each person makes decisions. Because the majority of us in here make decisions for a reason we don't know. Now, when I take my spouse and I go shopping, I ruin the shopping experience. She's like, oh, I love this. I'm like, I'm telling you why it's priced like that. Don't buy it. She's like, go away in the car. I don't want you here. So I will ruin the shopping experience. But I'm human just like everybody else. So I'll go somewhere and be like, that was genius. I went to IKEA and there was a desk that I wanted and it was sold out. But it didn't say it's sold out. It said, we're oversold. That's genius. How come I didn't think of that? So just as much as consumers try to fool everyone else, I get fooled just as much as the next person. So I may be the, I guess you could say, I don't know, subject matter expert in the field, but I still am human. I'm still susceptible to the same human behavior that we all are. And it's phenomenal. The reasons we make decisions aren't actually the reasons we think we make decisions.
So you kind of explained what behavior consumer psychology is, and that was going to be my next question. So is there anything else you can add on to that in terms of kind of defining what that is exactly and how it applies to a business?
Absolutely. Let's play a game. Everybody here drink beer? Okay, I see some smiles now. All right. So imagine you're laying on a hot beach on a hot day, and you want nothing more than your favorite brand of beer. Your friend says, I'm going to get up. I'm going to go to the only place around, that small, rundown grocery store, and I'll get your favorite brand of beer. If it costs as much or less than the price you're willing to pay. So to recap, your friend's going to get you a beer and bring it back to you on the beach from the only place around. It's a small, rundown grocery store, and they'll only get it for you if it costs as much or less than the price you're willing to pay. How much you want to pay for that beer? Now, you don't have to call out a price, but everyone in their mind has a price. Okay? Now, if I was to change the scenario a little bit, same exact scenario, and tell you that the only place around is a fancy resort. Now you may say, I'll pay the same amount for that beer. But the research shows that it's a $3 difference in the average cost. Meanwhile, that favorite beer was more than likely manufactured in the same place, delivered by the same truck, sold in the same bottle, and you're consuming it on the beach. You're not consuming it at the location where you purchased it from. So why is the perceived value different than the economic value of the beer? Yet each person here is more likely to spend $3 more per beer when it's the same beer. I'll cover a little more too. One more, I'll give you one more analogy. Let's play another game. So let's talk about Steve. Steve is a meek and tidy soul. He likes to read, keep to himself. He's somewhat an introvert. Is Steve more likely to be a librarian or a farmer? Let's see some hands. Who says he's going to be a farmer? Librarian? Okay, probably half and half. Okay, usually the majority goes with librarian. But yet I gave you enough information about Steve that could fit into a tweet. So out of 140 characters or less, you stereotyped Steve's career. You said he's going to be a librarian. He's going to be a farmer. I don't think Steve appreciates that very much. So, but the key word there is more likely. It's a statistical number there that in North America, for every one male librarian, there's 20 male farmers. So statistically, Steve's more than likely to be a meek and tidy farmer.
That's correct. I'm a farmer. No, I'm just kidding. So, all right. So does consumer behavior psychology work? I mean, it seems like it's everywhere. Like it's even on your menu at the restaurant. So it works. Tell us why is it working?
It works because we don't know what happens. If you identify that an organization, a brand, or a product is really being persuasive to you to force you to buy something, it's going to make you feel uncomfortable and not want to purchase and leave anyway. So if you ever identify that it's happening, then it's not working. We buy products every day, and we buy them in manners that we don't even know it's happening or don't even know that we're being persuaded. And that's how businesses know that it's working. So like the anchoring on the restaurant. If you drive down any main street in Winston-Salem, you're gonna pass by a McDonald's, a Burger King, a Wendy's, Hardee's, Arby's, any other fast food. And what that all these restaurants have in common is that their logos have the combination or have either red or yellow or a combination of red and yellow in the color. And what that does is red and yellow trigger hunger. So you may not know that you're being anchored into a decision, but cognitively they're telling you, eat this Big Mac, okay? And you may not buy it that day, but eventually you'll probably buy it. Think about when you go Google something, I wanna buy a new tie today, and you Google red tie. For the next 2 weeks, you're gonna see pop-up ads about this damn red tie everywhere you go. Get away from me. So they may not make that first sale initially, but businesses know that it takes average of 9 digital impressions to make a sale. So you may have loyalty to one company over another, but when you see that 9th digital impression, companies know you're gonna make that sale. More so, think about when you're buying goods on Amazon, Walmart.com, Target, or any website. It could be your own website. Who here has a website to sell products on and services? Do you have a shopping cart? Where's your shopping cart located at? In the top right-hand corner. It's because human eye tracking shows that when you read a newspaper or read a website, the human eye goes to the top right. It's the first place you go. So if you see that one or that two sitting in the shopping cart, it's a cognitive nudge to tell you, hey, something is here. They're reminding you to buy something. So they know where your eye goes. So that's why you don't see the shopping cart in the bottom left of the screen, the left or the center. It's always in the top right.
So one thing I learned from this is, like, if I go eat the Big Mac, I can just tell my wife, it's not me. Like, they're convincing me to eat this, right?
Right. It's not me. It's you.
All right. So with Barbera Solutions, you do this for a living. You help clients to determine, you know, how they can use different consumer behavior psychology tactics on their website, maybe even offline, on how they can grow their brand and their business. So can you give me an example of maybe a client you've worked with where prior to you working with them to working with them now, how you've helped their business out?
I'll share one that we could all relate to. Everyone here has been to Harris Teeter. So we work with Harris Teeter and Kroger and their other company, Fred Meyer. And we did this in one of each store. We did one in one Harris Teeter, one in one Kroger, and then one in Fred Meyer. If you're not familiar with Fred Meyer is, it's like a Walmart on crack. Okay, it's a really awesome store. If you ever go to the Northwest, check one out. I like it. I wish we had one here. So what we did was we put RFID chips in all of the shopping carts or the buggies, what do you want to call them? And then we can't see what is going into the shopping carts or who's buying what. But what we can see in real time is where that shopping cart is traversing throughout the store. And then we can see in heat maps, well, the average time someone stops at this intersection of two aisles is 16 seconds. And the average time that someone stops period in the store is about 3 seconds. So why is the average person or the majority of people stopping at this intersection for 13 seconds longer? So we figure out, okay, what's at the intersection of the store? We see what the products are there. Well, okay, so now we ask people, what do people typically want to cook with these two items? Now think about when you're shopping at Thanksgiving. You come across the green beans, and you're gonna see the fried onions. You're gonna see everything else you can make with green bean casserole. They bundle everything together, because if you're gonna buy one, more than likely to buy others. So then we start looking at consumer data. Now, when you go to Harris Teeter or Food Lion, you have that MVP rewards card. It's fun because you get 5% off on a purchase, but what they're doing is collecting data on you. They're knowing what you're purchasing. So they see that you go there every 2 weeks and you buy Fairlife milk, Halo Top ice cream, and a head of lettuce. So now they know what you're buying and how you buy it together. So more so when we look at that heat mapping, we see what people are buying in conjunction with what's on that shelf. So then we'll push it towards that area. But not only will we push the items to that area, we'll push an item to that area that costs 3 cents more. Well, if the average turnover in a grocery store is, say, 25 items per week, and if you can increase that by 3 cents, 3 cents times 25 times a month, that makes a lot of money over one customer over the cost of a year. So it makes a significant difference. You may not see that, you know, significant return on investment in one time, in 1 week, but over the course of 2-3 years, that could be 0.5% in profit margin increase. And 0.5% in a store like Harris Teeter or Kroger that has thousands of products and SKUs in their store, that's a lot of money.
Wow. So, I mean, this is irrelevant, but out of curiosity, like, what were people spending most time, what aisle were they spending the most time in?
Well, it's mostly in the freezer section, anywhere with refrigerated goods. And that's for the easy answer is that the most common items purchased in the grocery store are milk and eggs. And hence why the milk and eggs are always in the back of the store is because you have to walk past everything else. So Harris Teeter, Kroger, Walmart aren't banking on you buying the most expensive item in the store. They're banking on you filling up your cart and buying more than one item. So if you have to walk across the store to buy milk and eggs and you pick up one other item, that's another item they sold.
Wow. So I'll be paying attention to that when I go to the grocery store.
I apologize for ruining your shopping experience.
So, all right. So let's say I'm a client. I want to work with you. What's the process that you would help me go through in order to come up with a strategy to use consumer behavior psychology in my business?
I'm not sure I want to work with you. So first thing we want to look is we want to see what data you're collecting, how you're collecting it, and that's really the depth, the breadth of that data. You may have all the answers you already need. So if someone's to tell you like, yeah, we'll do all this research for you, but the majority of businesses actually have the data that they already need. They just may not be analyzing it correctly and looking for their gaps in research. So for example, if you identify that you want to identify who is your target customer, and you think, well, my target customer is a 45 to 54 year old female, earns between $45,000 and $65,000 annually, lives within 4 miles of a major metropolitan area, and drinks coffee twice a day. Looking at the data, you might be able to refine that more to say, well, our target audience is caffeinated Kathy. Caffeinated Kathy is 41 to 61 years old, drinks coffee from a local coffee shop 3 times a week, and drinks homemade coffee on the weekends, enjoys NASCAR with her husband, has 2 kids, 1 kid's in college, and you just refine it more and more. So just by looking at your data, you might actually have what you need. So before we even say we want to work with her, we want to know how much data you have. We want to see how much you're collecting, how you're collecting it, and then what are you trying to answer? So a lot of times people may come and say, well, we have a problem with logistics. Okay, is how do we know logistics is actually the problem? Why is logistics the problem? Well, it's because this. Well, why is that the problem? And you ask why enough times, and you really find out, okay, maybe this is the reason why you're seeing a concern here. And then we'll look into that a little bit. We'll do some research and say, all right, now we identified what we think is our hypothesis. What is the answer we can, what is the problem we can answer? And then we look at your data. We might be able to answer it this way. And if you don't have the data, then we would recommend doing some research ourselves to answer that question for you, and then look, follow through, and then put it into practice.
Okay, so my next question was actually, what are some examples of how this would not work? But from hearing your previous answer, it seems like if you don't have data collected, I guess it makes it a little bit more difficult to determine what route to take.
Yes, I would agree. So I want to cover that more of a personal behavioral aspect, is that, so we found this out very early on, that we can make recommendations to companies, say, do this course of action and XYZ is likely to happen. Okay, sounds good. But if the systems you're using or the systems that we recommend don't work well with your employees, your team members, the strategy is not going to work, period. So what we also want to do is look at what systems you're currently using, which systems or platforms, websites, services you're using that your employees actually like to use, and build a strategy around what your employees like to do. So if we can make your employees like to do this or enjoy it, then the chances of having a successful strategy significantly increases.
So what are some other tools you can recommend to the audience here? You know, we have entrepreneurs in the audience. We have people just starting businesses, people who may be working on their own, you know, trying to start their business. In terms of collecting data, which is important in order to determine, you know, how to convince your consumer about your brand or the things that you offer, what are some tools you would recommend to them?
So I'll give 3 tools. The first is Google Analytics. Okay, for someone in that has a startup or is say pre-large revenue, Google Analytics provides a significant amount of data for you that you can track your customers and get a good answer about what they're doing, how they're engaging with your product. And the second part is integrate that with Google's Data Studio. It's in beta right now, but it's a phenomenal product. So if you don't know how to use SPSS or maximize your potential with Excel, with statistics, use Google's Data Studio. Very user-friendly. Integrate the two together. The other part I'll say is don't directly ask your customers what they want or how they engage with your product. If you ask them, what do you do with this product or how do you like it, they're going to give you an answer that's not going to be accurate. So ask them other ways. Ask them ways of how likely are you to use this here? How likely are you to integrate this here? And then match that to the data that you're collecting. And then be creative in the way you come up with solutions and products and services.
Good. Those are really good tips. So my last question before we go into the Q&A, which I know the audience loves to ask questions to our guest speaker, was to give us, you know, 3 takeaways. And you already touched upon that with some tools that we can use to, you know, analyze how our consumers are reacting to our website, our business. But do you have any other tips that you can provide us in terms of things that we can use to just learn a little bit more about our consumer?
I would say the first thing would be ethics. So this doesn't really help us learn about the consumer, but it helps the consumer trust you. And if the consumer can trust you, hopefully that consumer will mature into a fully connected consumer who will then advocate for your products and services to anyone they meet, anywhere they go. So being persuasive, like I said earlier, is that if the consumer knows they're being persuaded, we've done it wrong. So just have good ethics in what you're doing. Don't try and force the consumer to do something that they don't want to do. So the second part of that, which segues right in actually, is to be humanizing, be authentic, be yourself. If your brand can have a face, and I don't mean like Aaron Rodgers or another quarterback to represent your brand, but just be humanizing, have fun with it. And use fun language. It creates a humanizing aspect between you and the consumer. Because we don't want to engage as consumers with just, you know, mahogany-walled attorneys and receptionists. We want to have fun. We want to know who we're talking to. We want to know who we're engaging with. And that really builds the consumer experience. And then the segue right into the consumer experience, really the last part, again, I probably said it was, is have fun. Make your consumers laugh. Make them enjoy using your product, because if they enjoy it, they're going to come back to you over and over again. And when I say enjoy and come back, if you have to forego the quick sale today to build a consumer relationship over the long term, forget the sale today. Because if you push someone to buy something today that they'll regret tomorrow, they're not going to come back. But if you give someone, say, some free information today, some reciprocity, they'll value that. And they'll come back to you in 9 months and thank you for it. And now they'll come back to you in 9 months, but probably come back to you in 9 months and 10 months and 11 months. And that the life cycle or the lifetime value of that consumer will be a lot more significant than it would be if they purchased one item and never came back to you tomorrow.
Great. Have y'all been taking notes? Lots of good information. All right, so let's go ahead and go into our Q&A. You guys are welcome to ask any questions to our guest speaker, and who wants to get started?
Any questions, huh? All right, yes. All right.
Anybody have any questions?
Oh, like you saying, with the face part, would you say that as well for people who most of their business is online? Would you say as far as social media, their face being out in front more and more, even though a lot of their products is not based on them, would you say that would be the best way to do it or not?
Is your question pertaining to maybe a personal brand?
Yeah, a personal brand, but it's based on products, and I'm a motivational speaker as well. So, but it's a lot of products out there also. So if you think about like Gary Vaynerchuk, he's out there all the time. You know, his product is advertising. It's completely different, but that brand is what sells all the rest of it.
Okay, and what's your name?
Janae Adams.
Janae. So I think that the best way to answer that question is if you're a personal brand, if you are the brand, so not only be humanizing, don't try and put everything out to your customers, but show some weakness. Show your challenges. Show where you went wrong, and they'll appreciate that. Nobody wants to hear from the person that had an overtly successful career and never did anything wrong. As a coach, obviously you had some lessons learned along the way. Share that. In 1985, I did this, and this is where I really screwed up, okay? And this is what I learned from that. If you share some weaknesses with your audience, I think you might find more potential to gain some more clients over the long term.
Any other questions?
As you said, don't rush into the sale today. In the process, when you make your first presentation, what is the next steps that you do to follow up in not rushing the sale, but to build a long-term relationship?
Are you asking me what I do or a recommendation in a general situation?
What do you do?
So what do I do is I don't target sales. So for example, if everyone here was to give me their business card, I'm not going to call you tomorrow. None of my employees are going to call you tomorrow and hound you for sales. Okay. If you need our help, call us. Okay. I'm in the consulting business. Majority of our sales come from referrals. So we value ourselves in the quality of work that we do. If we provide quality work, then hopefully you'll refer us to someone else. If we stop providing quality work, then guess we shouldn't be in this line of work anyway. So we don't overtly seek sales. What we do is we maintain a relationship with you. So if you give me your business card, I'll maintain communication with you. Maybe I'll reach out to you in a few months and check how you're doing. And that's really it, but I'm not gonna ask you for a sale. I may invite you, say, hey, I'm gonna be back in Winston again in a few months. Come on out to this. You might get something similar to what you got from today. Hopefully you get something from today. Just maintaining that relationship. So in consulting or in personal brands, relationship building is significant. It's going to be majority of your long-term success.
Like, do you have anything from traditional, I guess, marketing or whatever, for until like the millennial? People who are born after 2000 or whatever, like, as far as, like, do you have any different type of strategies for that?
Are you asking how to target to Generation X and millennials?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So here's my answer to that. Break it down even further, because there are a lot of different segments in millennials. So let's use millennials, for example, not just Generation Y and X. So if we take them millennials. So if you ask a millennial, how likely are you to buy the camera in the back of the room? Okay. A millennial that lives in New York City will give you one answer. A millennial that lives in Los Angeles will give you a different answer. A millennial that lives in Henderson, North Carolina will give you a different answer. If you ask a millennial to give you five adjectives on the shirt that I'm wearing, you're going to get five different answers from the one that lives in Los Angeles. You're going to get five different answers between the one that lives in New York City. And if you take five different millennials that live in New York City, you're going to get five different adjectives based upon income, the way they were raised, the ethnicity, the demographics, where they go to work, how they get to work. So look into the sub-behaviors of each person. So break down into segments. So don't just segment between millennial and Generation X, but segment within. So segment, segment, segment. Find ages, find behaviors, find what they like to do, okay? Think about if we all here had one business and our business was selling car seats. Okay, if we're going to sell car seats, who is the user of the car seat? The user is a child, okay? But when was the last time we saw a child swipe a credit card? Now, if you find one, please call me, because I want to do some social research on this individual. So the end user may be the child, but who's going to purchase it? The mother. I like how you said, one person said parents, and someone else, most people said the mother. So if there's a mother-to-be, or a mother with a newly born child, and there's two parents, who is the primary decision maker in that scenario? The mother, okay? Majority of us that have families, it's gonna be the mother making the decision for the welfare of that child, okay? It's just the social norms. And yes, we stereotype there. We say, well, the male, you know what? He's not gonna be the decision. Maybe he doesn't care enough, maybe he doesn't know enough. But typically in social norms, we stereotype and say the mother is the primary decision maker there. So target the behavior. So if we were selling to that mother, where can we find that mother? Where can we sell to her? Where does she go? A mother-to-be, maybe 6 to 9 months pregnant, in the market to buy a car seat. Where can we find this individual? All right, so now we start stereotyping. Grocery stores, doctor's offices. Okay, we can start figuring out where this person is, and we can start designing campaigns from there. Okay, so a person who's also going to be a mother-to-be, what kind of car are they driving? I hear a lot of answers. So let's reframe the message. What kind of car is she not driving? A sports car. That's a very common answer, okay? So now we know who that customer is not. And if you can continue to segment and segment and segment and really define a customer or target avatar, what you did is two things. You defined who's potentially going to buy your product, and you saved yourself a lot of money. So instead of buying a television ad for $50,000 to $75,000 and targeting everyone, you can use that information on Google with AdWords or Facebook and target a specific behavior, spend a lot less money, and get a much larger return on your investment.
Hey, how are you? Thank you. What's one professional development opportunity and publication that you just have to pursue every year and that you don't put down?
That is a really good question. The one for me, I have to think about this for a moment. The one professional development that I do every year in, every year out, I would say conference attending. Now, this is going to be a broad answer. So I don't go to the same conferences for professional development every year. There are some that I really enjoy, but even those I go every other year and probably sometimes every 3 years, just because sometimes it's the same content. But what I get out of going to conferences for professional development, so for consulting, there's probably a plethora of conferences that focus on developing your consulting practice, building a consulting firm, engaging with consulting clients. Now, not all of them apply to me. I may go to one this year, but I didn't go to one next year. But the thing, my favorite one, I would say my favorite conference is for the Association of Consumer Research. And I'm actually going to attend their conference again this year. It's in San Diego in October.
I'm really looking forward to one because it's in San Diego. Get to have fun while I'm there. But there's a really good lineup of research that's being presented. But now, again, that's a research conference. It's not consulting. So I like to reframe the message myself and take different contexts out of where I go. So when I'm going to this conference to learn about consumer research, they're not going there to tell me how to sell this to customers or how to use it in practice. They're telling me what the research is. Now I'm gonna sit there, I'm gonna read the research, I'll listen to the speakers, and then I'll learn from there. But not only do I learn on how to apply this to my clients, but I learn to my own research methodologies. Wow, this researcher here used this methodology with this kind of segment of the population. I was like, I have not heard that before, it's really interesting. So I'll really dig into that and learn more there. So I try to learn more than just what the actual conference teaches us. So the Association for Consumer Research is one of my favorites. An early one for me that I used a long time ago that I probably should go back to, Toastmasters. I love Toastmasters, I don't use it anymore. I tell myself I'm gonna go do it. It's just, behavior change is tough to get myself off this chair and go do it. So if you email me in a week and ask me, did you go join Toastmasters? Nudge me, make me go do it.
Okay, Michael, I hope that I can phrase this in the correct way. You said them before that you have a bunch of nonprofits as clients. How you make the approach to them? Because one, the perception is totally blunt because they are requesting money from donors directly, so there is no persuasion behind, except for the ask and triggering some kind of emotions in people, like sadness or pretty much sadness and compassion. And so how you transfer that in your case to the nonprofit sector?
That's a really good question. So, does anybody else have nonprofits or work with nonprofits? Okay. Or anything with social change or politics? Okay. So this will apply to the majority of that. And if you can probably apply some of this to a for-profit model, go for it. So with the nonprofit model, focus on who is the hero. Who's the hero in the situation? So first you have to identify who the customer is, and then figure out of all these different segments, who is the hero that benefits from that nonprofit? Okay, so let's use an example. We have a research hospital that's a not-for-profit hospital. Doctors are heroes. They save people's lives every day. Patients are heroes because they come in, day out and get cancer treatment. They don't have to do it. They can do it voluntarily. You don't have to do anything on a doctor. No one forces your hand to go get treatment. But to go day in and day out to get radioactive treatment and feel the side effects for that and continue to go, you can be considered a hero. So when designing a marketing campaign for donors, who do we focus on? Do we focus on the hero that's the patient, or we focus on the hero that's the doctor? Now, we can do both. I wouldn't recommend that because then you confuse the audience with two different calls to action. So I'll give you an example. Furthermore, that example is that one hospital used the doctors as the heroes. Another hospital used the patients as the heroes. The hospital that used the patient as the heroes in their marketing campaign saw 25 times larger return on investment than the hospital that used the doctors, because the recipients, the people who received the message, perceive the hospital using as the doctors as the heroes, although they are. They have a skill that I can't do, and I consider them a hero too, but they viewed it as self-serving, as selfish. When people are sick and dying and need treatment, why focus on the people who make six figures a year and possibly even more? So try and figure out who the hero is there. And then if you narrow it down to two different segments that are heroes, do some research first and find who the hero is. And if you can exploit who the hero is in the situation and share their message and share their story, you're more than likely to have a successful campaign.
One last question with Jeanette.
And the last question is, how did you get your first Fortune 50 client? What did that look like, the preparation, the pitch, the actual meeting, or however it went?
You already had one question, so I have to give this to somebody else. So relationship building, referrals. So for a lot of people who have a personal brand and they're just starting out, a significant challenge is networking, is finding those buyers, finding the individuals who would hire you who are in those organizations, and that could be a significant challenge. So yes, do we still have those today? Yeah, so if I was to ask one client, hey, can you give us 3 referrals? Okay, we might get 3, but then getting that person on the phone could be a little bit of a challenge. Sometimes out of the 6 referrals we get, 2 will say, yeah, I want to talk to you, and just call us right away. So sometimes it's more fortunate. But starting out, for me, because I started as an entrepreneur so young, I kind of build my network at a very young age. And although I can say I have a very large network today, on the grand scheme of business and networking, it's still very, very small. And I can't say I know less than 0.0001% of the actual people that actually could buy my services. So just building relationships, be humanizing, be yourself. I would never say cold call, but ask for referrals, okay? If you have clients today, ask them for other people who would benefit from the value that you provide in those exact words.
All right, thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for driving down here. We appreciate it. So you can come on this way.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.